Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. You know how some people are like, well, I like to cook, but I don't like to bake. And if you ask them why, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll tell you it's because, you know, they can kind of wing it with cooking, but they hate having to follow a recipe when baking. Well, we're thinking about the wing it thing, because lots of people don't really know how to do that. So we wanted to find out how a couple of great cooks started to learn how to do that. Last year, we got to Vivian Howard and Nick Sharma, and I think you're going to want to learn to cook like them too. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, can I tell you something that will probably make you think less of me? I hate the movie Ratatouille. Absolutely hate it. We'll never watch it again. I don't want my kid to see it. And it's because, well, first of all, it's because I just can't stand Cyrano de Bergerac type stories, because I always feel so angry at the world that true love has to be filtered through some dopey avatar. But mostly, I hate that movie because it has the worst conception of what it means to be a great cook that I have ever seen. Okay, so what? Like, basically, the rat has a perfect palate and has memorized every recipe and, like, every flavor combination known to man, and just because he doesn't have 2 human-sized hands, he can't be the greatest chef in all of France, boo-hoo. So he jumps on the head, and very unsanitarily, mind you, hides in the hat of some goofball, whispers recipes into his ear, and suddenly amazing food appears. And that is not how cooking works! Because cooking is all about the hands! You do not get to be called a great cook just because you are a rat who can speak human language and have an encyclopedic knowledge of cuisine. But look, cooking is all about touch and feel and instinct that you build up by actually cooking. And so, if you're still with me, after I've mercilessly slandered this cute little cartoon rat, that is what this episode is about this week. Cooking by feel. How we develop those instincts and that literal sense of touch. So we talked to 2 fantastic cooks to learn how they developed their feel for cooking. And maybe we can figure out a little something about how we work with our own instincts. Later in the show, we're going to talk with Nick Sharma, a microbiologist turned cookbook author. And we start with Chef Vivian Howard. Vivian has restaurants in the Carolinas, most notably The Chef and the Farmer in Kinston, North Carolina. She was the star of the Peabody and Emmy Award-winning show, A Chef's Life, and she's the author of 2 cookbooks. Her new one is called This Will Make It Taste Good. So, hey, Chef, it's great to talk with you.
Great talking to you, too. Thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. So, hey, I was reading your new cookbook, and one of the recipes really jumped out at me. It's for, I believe you call it chicken toast.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, reading the method, you basically slap some chicken legs on bread and shove it in the oven. And it's a brilliant idea. You know, the chicken starts to drip into the bread, the fat comes out and crisps the edges. Like right when I read it, I'm like, oh God, that sounds great. I totally want to make it. But it also made me think, it's kind of a far cry from like the early part of your career, I think, when you were working in New York City for like hyper precise chefs, like very sciencey chef like Wiley Dufresne, and you were probably like measuring ingredients out to the 10th of a gram. So would you say that your sense of how good cooking works has changed over time?
Absolutely. The first part of my career was, as you said, really focused around this, you know, very precise molecular gastronomy. And that type of cooking was what I thought I needed to master in order, you know, to be a successful chef.
Mm-hmm.
And that all changed at some point when I moved back to North Carolina, because that food did not resonate here. I wasn't really into measuring. I hated using scales. And ultimately, I had finally like learned to cook, and I could kind of follow my nose and my ears and my mouth.
Yeah.
You know, I learned basics in culinary school, and then I, you know, jumped, sure, you know, thousands of yards to, you know, this precision cooking. And then when I moved back to Eastern North Carolina from New York, I became really interested in the food of my place. A story I like to tell that kind of, you know, exemplifies what happened was my mom, who was about 70 years old at the time, had surgery. And to do something nice for her, I decided that I would make her chicken and rice, which is a very basic comfort food. Basically, you know, you boil a chicken till it's falling apart and then cook rice in that broth, and it's seasoned with lots of black pepper. And it was the comfort food of my youth. But learning what I had learned in New York with all the fancy chefs, I just knew that I could improve vastly on my mom's version. So I was going to make her, you know, chicken and rice for her recovery. And so I like roasted chicken bones, made a stock, put all kinds of aromatics and herbs in there, and wanted her chicken and rice to be soupier. So I used less rice. And I mean, what happened didn't even taste good to me, but I felt like, you know, I followed all the rules from all the French cookbooks. And so I vacuum sealed that. I had one of these machines at the time. I vacuum sealed little packets of the chicken and rice up for my mom, put it in her freezer before she got home. And about a week later, I went in to check on her supply. And I said, I noticed that only one bag was gone. And I'm like, Mom, don't forget about this chicken and rice in here. And she's like, oh, it's awful. I don't know what you did to it. And I was 6 months pregnant with twins at the time and like completely out of my mind. And so I like reached into her freezer, like turned my pregnancy blouse inside out, put all those packets of chicken and rice in it, and waddled across the yard to my house and flung them on the floor and flung myself on the couch and cried and thought about how I had never paid attention to the way my mom cooked. I dismissed basically everything she did and felt like obviously my training had taken me beyond her expertise. And the thing that I remember about my chicken and rice, ridiculous chicken and rice, when it was cooking the whole time, I was like, this doesn't smell like my mom's. And it was like at that moment that I thought, you know, there's so much more to cooking than, you know, following recipes and brunoise knife work. And that's probably the moment that I started following my senses.
So how did you learn? And your first, actually, I should tell you, it's so funny to hear you say this because, you know, I also went to culinary school, and one thing that they pound into your head over and over and over again is whenever you're cooking meat, you got to sear it, right? And to get a good sear on meat, you have to take it out of the fridge a half hour before you cook it. You got to pat it dry. And, you know, all these, you know, even beyond that, all these ornate Baroque techniques to drying the meat. Some people's, you know, you put it on a rack in the fridge uncovered so that it can like desiccate the outside. So you get that dry, you know, pellicle on it so you can sear it and get really good caramelization brown. And all that stuff is great. Sure, cool. But then, like, then I just try to go home and make a simple stir fry like I would have had in my house growing up, and I just couldn't do it. I'm like totally paralyzed.
Yeah, you knew too much.
Yeah.
And way too little.
But anyway, so now here you are crying, all these frozen packets of chicken and rice around you, and you want to learn to cook a different way. You want to sort of deprogram all that like precision recipe based, you have to do it X, Y, and Z way cooking out of you. What did you do?
Well, I asked a lot of questions. I mean, you certainly don't ask for recipes because they don't have any. You know, why, Mom, do you boil this chicken for 2 hours? You know, that goes against everything that I've learned is correct. And, you know, the answer is you want the broth to taste as chickeny as possible. And I'm trying to use the meat as well. So why not pardon the pun, kill two birds with one stone. And that just made so much sense. And so I started thinking about, you know, yeah, there are lots of rules and there are lots of ways to do things, but most of those recipes and rules are designed so that one cook does it exactly like the chef that taught him or her, or mm-hmm. the chef that wrote the cookbook. But I'm cooking in large part for me and for my family and for my customers, and they're here to experience my food. So, you know, thinking about what makes sense for me and my kitchen, and my taste, and, you know, really thinking outside the recipes. I mean, I think recipes are a relatively new invention for home cooks. I mean, you know, I don't know if you watched your mom follow recipes growing up, but I certainly didn't. I mean, she flipped through Southern Living magazines and looked at recipes for cakes, but all of the savory cooking in my house was done from, you know, from taste and smell and, you know, just the things that she had already eaten, always eaten. So I think that we have gotten away from just cooking from the hip and really trusting our instincts, because we know too much. We have too much information to follow our own gut.
Okay, but you need to be able to communicate to your cooks, for instance, in a restaurant setting, and you know, to folks who are just your neighbors, whoever, say, "Oh, hey, Vivi, how do you make this thing?" So how do you do that? How do you teach people what you know, what you see, what you feel, and how do you sort of give them the confidence to trust themselves, even if it's not exactly like what you told them?
Right. Well, I think, you know, when you're building any number of dishes in the kitchen, there's so many things that you do the same every single time. If I'm making a sauce or a stew or a soup or a braise, I always start by sweating the aromatics. You know, that's a step I think every home cook and every line cook should understand. You know, there's steps to be taken. And there are rules that we always follow, like season all the way through. You know, you can't just slap salt at the end of something. You know, if you do, it tastes like salt's on top of it and not in it. You know, the thing that I preach over and over is just taste all the time. And, you know, season judiciously throughout, but season all the way throughout. And keep in mind that you can add, but you can't take away. So there are, you know, basic fundamental rules that we follow. You know, one of my rules that I preach over and over is like acid in the end, acid in the beginning, you know, finish with brightness, even if it's a really, you know, meant to be a heavy, hearty dish, like a touch of brightness at the end really elevates it and makes it even more appealing. So while I don't focus on, you know, following the recipe to a T, you know, there are basic fundamentals that all of my cooks and anyone who asks me a question is going to hear.
That's Vivian Howard, author of This Will Make It Taste Good. And stick around because she's going to help us take your cooking calls. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, so we're spending this episode talking about cooking with your instincts. And Chef Vivian Howard is with me to take your cooking questions. And if you have questions for us for a future show, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Now let's get back to Vivian and your calls. Are you ready to take some calls with me?
Sure.
All right, great. Let's go to Lauren.
Hi, my name is Lauren, and I have a very picky 2-year-old who doesn't like to eat vegetables. And I'm trying to figure out other ways to hide vegetables that aren't zucchini bread. I have made more zucchini bread than I know what to do with, and would love to find other ways to slip those vegetables in so he'll actually eat them. Thanks so much. Love the show.
Well, I think I could write a masterclass in hiding vegetables. I have 2 9-year-olds, a boy and a girl, and despite my very best efforts, they're picky eaters. So, Lauren, spinach is your friend. If you have a 2-year-old, she's picky now, it's probably only going to get worse. So you can start with a smoothie with spinach in it. I know a lot of people put kale in smoothies, but spinach has a much more mild flavor and texture, meaning it, you know, blends up much easier in a smoothie. So, you know, if your 2-year-old is like my kids, they can spot something green from across town. You know, you want to make your smoothie with dark fruit if you're putting spinach in it. So like, you know, blueberries, blackberries, spinach, maybe some yogurt, orange juice, ice. So you've got something green in a cup that he or she will probably really like. Also, chicken soup. You know, we all love a creamy chicken soup. You can make it creamy by adding like cauliflower puree, sweet potato puree, butternut squash puree. That's going to give the soup body. Your 2-year-old's probably going to like it. It's going to make it richer. And you've got, you know, some really helpful vegetables in there. Whenever I make meatloaf or spaghetti sauce, I not only blend spinach with the tomatoes, I also grate carrots into meatball or meatloaf mix. They actually improve it, you know, because they're adding a little bit of sweetness and moisture. Yeah, so you've got a long road ahead of you. Yes. I hope that I've helped a little bit.
Well, I've spoken like someone who's really gone through it.
I've gone to great lengths. Yeah. I have to share this. My daughter is a cheese hound and she loves macaroni and cheese. And so I'm like, okay, I'll make macaroni and cheese once a week if you don't mind, if it's green. So I blend spinach with the milk that I'm going to make the cheese sauce with. So we have green mac and cheese and you can't taste the difference.
Oh, that's amazing. Funny enough, my kid really likes mac and cheese too. And I try not to make it as often as once a week, but same thing. I was like, okay, you know, mac and cheese, but there's going to be diced sweet potato in it.
Right.
I guess I would also say if your kid is not like militantly anti-vegetable, frankly, at least 49% of the time they just want to hurt your feelings. Yeah, they like the look. Yeah, the deadening look in your eyes every time they flick out that little bit of red pepper or whatever. But if it's just a matter of making it more palatable, a couple of things I would say to keep in mind. You know, I have a 5-year-old who thankfully has tended to like vegetables, or at least will eat widely. But I often forget this, because I like bitter vegetables so much. I like dark leafy greens. Kids are actually much more sensitive to bitter flavor. And so I think they might just taste kale differently than you do. So maybe sweeter vegetables, like Vivian said, spinach is a great one, or peppers that have a lot of sweetness, cucumbers. And the other thing I think about too is like, add lots of different flavors that you know they do. Like kids love umami, Parmesan cheese, tomato sauce, soy sauce, fish sauce. They naturally love that flavor. Cook your vegetables with that. Like I hard roast broccoli, like 450 degrees with literally nothing but salt and olive oil, but in florets, so all the edges get super frizzled. My kid loves it. And then if I put Parmesan on top of that, forget it. It's like, that's all she needs. She'll eat a whole bowl of it. So I think crispiness is great. Umami is great. And like hard roasting caramelized flavors is also great.
And I think what Francis said about the emotional nature of it is really important, because my kids learned really early on that it made me emotional when they wouldn't eat vegetables. And so now it's a thing. It's one of the major dynamics in our house. So don't let her see sweat.
And don't bargain. Don't promise dessert for eating vegetables.
Don't promise to make mac and cheese once a week. Yeah.
All right, let's go to Kara in Portland.
Hi, Splendid Table. I live in a mostly vegetarian house, and in particular, my husband really doesn't like chicken. I seem to have a thing for cutting out recipes from the newspaper that involve chicken. I have two in front of me. One's called Simple Butter Chicken, and it looks delicious. And I have another one that's from the New York Times, Dijon chicken with shallots and white wine. And the sauce just looks like creamy and tomatoey and looks amazing to me. But we don't really cook chicken in our house. So I was just wondering if you could recommend something else. I mean, I know I could do it with like tofu or something, but I just was wondering, like, is there something that chicken like releases into the dish that makes it really yummy? And if so, could you recommend something other than chicken? So anyway, thanks. Bye.
Speaking of children, I think I hear some in Kara's background. So what do you think, Vivian?
I think it's good news because what it sounds like is what she's drawn to is the sauce.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's good news because if you're looking for the flavor of chicken, you're really not going to be able to achieve something similar in a vegetarian sense. You can incorporate, right, you know, elements of umami and richness, but I think what you're drawn to is the sauce. And so I would suggest, like, you know, swapping the chicken out for maybe a head of like hen of the woods mushrooms or lion's mane mushrooms, and almost treating it the same. If the chicken calls for being the skin being rendered, you know, pan fry the mushrooms, which will build up a little fond, hopefully, on the bottom of your pan, that you can then add those shallots and the wine and whatever else went into that sauce.
Yeah.
And you can build a velvety, really satisfying, rich sauce just that way. And, you know, if you wanted to add additional notes of umami, like, I don't know if it's okay to say this on Splendid Table, but like maybe a little MSG or a little nutritional yeast or, you know, something that's going to give it additional depth.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm glad you picked up on that because it does seem like if what appeals to you is the sauce or all the different components of the dish, go ahead and like roast up some of your favorite vegetables. I mean, some dishes really highlight the chickeniness of chicken, and I do enjoy those. But a lot of times it's just that recipe is built that way because we're used to having meat be the center of the plate and chicken is a more neutral meat. And, you know, so it's kind of a blank canvas on its own. And so everything else around it is kind of the flavor star, the flavor hero, I know, as you like to call it. And the chicken is just kind of like the backdrop. And if that's the case, go ahead and roast some of your favorite vegetables and use those as the backdrop instead.
You know, yeah, that butter chicken that you mentioned, I'm pretty sure I know ballpark what that is. And it would be just as good with roasted vegetables slathered in that sauce over some rice. So you probably won't miss the chicken.
Right on. All right, we have time for, I think, one more. So let's go to Megan in Chicago.
Hey, Splendid Table. I have some things that have been sitting in my pantry for a while, and I want to use them up, wondering if you have any good ideas. So I have an unopened bottle of black vinegar that was going to be part of a cooking project that never actually happened. And I have a can of evaporated milk. Not expecting these things to be going together, but if you have any creative ideas that are healthy, maybe kind of fresh or exciting, I am all ears. Thanks a bunch.
I love that she called in because she wants to know what to do with black vinegar and a can of evaporated milk. Like, this is not like...
No, I'm glad she knows they don't have to go together, yeah, though.
Yeah. How do you like to use them? I actually love both of these ingredients, I got to tell you.
Well, I do too. And, you know, the interesting thing about evaporated milk is that it's, you know, basically you can use it anywhere that you would want like a slightly thicker, slightly sweeter milk. So, you know, smoothies, macaroni and cheese, you could certainly use it there.
Oh,
it's like really a nice treat in coffee. My daughter, you know, when she was younger, we would have little tea parties and we would put evaporated milk in one of the little pitchers. And she just thought that was the greatest thing. So I don't know that, Megan, you're going to be having tea parties, but just think of it as a little thicker, little sweeter milk. And black vinegar is a great ingredient to have around. I don't think that after you use this bottle, it'll be your last because it's a oddly from my taste perspective, like fruitier vinegar than your red wine vinegars or sherry vinegars, but it's not as sweet as a balsamic vinegar. I think it makes a great swap out for anywhere you're going to add lemon, you know, like green beans with lemon and almonds could be green beans with black vinegar and almonds.
Oh, cool.
So just think of it, you know, as a swap out for a fruitier acid.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, black vinegar, it's funny because I grew up with it in the house. It's a traditionally Chinese ingredient. And two places where you see it the most often are just by itself in a dish. And then what you do is you take some ginger, fresh ginger, and shred the fresh ginger super thin, super fine, and just kind of drop it in the vinegar. And just let them hang out together for a few minutes. It doesn't have to be like a long marination, maceration kind of thing. And that is actually a really nice dip for dumplings. And like you said, it's not very sweet, but it's typically not crazy puckery sour. Mm-hmm. I think the blackness comes from age and it mellows out that like harsh acidity. Mm-hmm. So it's like a nice mellow tartness. So it's a great little dip for that. And funny enough, the only time I've ever seen it like used hardcore is to braise pig's feet, which my mom would eat after giving birth. That's like a traditional thing. Pig's feet and ginger braised in black vinegar. But I don't know if Megan is going to go that route. evaporated milk too. Like, yeah, same thing. Like I love what you said about tea because drawing on my experience too growing up, that was like the milk to use if you want to do like a Hong Kong style milk tea. Make a really strong black tea and use evaporated milk as your milk and a little bit of sugar. And it's, boy. It's great. It puts me on the streets of Hong Kong.
I might need that for my afternoon pick-me-up.
Yeah, now I'm thinking about it too. Well, Jeff, it was great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Vivian Howard's latest book is This Will Make It Taste Good. And she left us with a recipe for her chicken with rice. You'll find it at splendidtable.org. In a life full of surprise plot twists, Nick Sharma moved from India, where he grew up, to America to study molecular genetics. Living extremely nerdily as a scientist, he also began cooking, and cooking seriously at home, and he started sharing it through his blog, A Brown Table. Fast forward a bit, and Nick has a new career. He's an award-winning cookbook author and is a cooking columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle and a regular contributor to Serious Eats and Food and Wine. Hey, Nick, it's great to talk with you.
Hi, Francis. Likewise.
You know what? I have been reading you for a number of years now, and I guess maybe we'll just start here. How did you learn to cook? Like, what drew you to cooking?
The fact that my mother hates to cook is what drew me to cooking. She's going to kill me out since I've said this. It's one of those things where both my parents worked during the day, and then whatever they wanted to put together, they put together. And my dad's also not the best cook in the world. My mom is a good cook. She's just not interested. She just finds it very cumbersome and doesn't care.
Sure.
And so actually right now with COVID, she's stuck with my sister. And I think my mother is fed up of cooking.
At some point, I realized I had cooked dinner for literally 100 straight nights. I'm like, wow, I've never done that before. And then that was, 200 nights ago.
And I mean, I'm a food writer and I do it for work. So even I get exhausted sometimes, especially during COVID, I need the break. But my mom, who is someone who just loads cooking. And so it's almost comical now just to hear her complain about it every week. But that's one of the reasons why I started to cook was, truth be told, it just wasn't very exciting to eat the same thing all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I started going through her recipes that she had saved prior to getting married and then after getting married to my dad. And there were all these delicious, almost magical entities in photos. Where back in the day they had chicken and they would put these little paper chef hats. I don't remember what they're called, but They had these little chef hats that would be attached to the legs of the chicken after it was cooked. Oh my god,
look at the cartoons. Like,
yeah, and I don't know
like
what
Bugs Bunny's coming out without the tray and the two and little chef hats on the leg.
As a child, it's always fascinating. And so I was like, why isn't she cooking these things? And so then I started to get out in by myself. I used to have Thursdays off from school, and that's when I kind of went in the kitchen. No one was at home, and so I would, you know, do what I wanted.
Yeah. And so because you mentioned the recipes, were the like, did you follow the recipes? Did you cook from them? Or did you like ask your mom, how do you make this? Like, I'm curious about the actual, like, how did you actually start to get the instruction? Yeah.
Also, for one, I was frightened to tell them anything because it was almost like doing something illegal at home. Because I did have a few accidents at home.
I mean, just set the kitchen on fire. It's not that big a deal, right?
Yeah. Well, I actually set the curtains on fire once. I don't even know if I told them, but I had learned, my mom had introduced me to acetone as the nail polish cleaner. And in chemistry, we had learned how acetone is produced. I was really fascinated. And I said, oh, it's a solvent, so maybe I can clean the grime that collects in between sliding windows. So I poured some acetone, and then I remembered it's flammable, so you could also dry it up quickly. So I set a matchstick.
Madness.
And so, yeah, so my
this is the definition of knowing enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, I know. So I guess to get into trouble for a lot of stuff like this, but it was so exciting because you're doing something like it was like a covert ops kind of thing. That's kind of the thing that drew me into food, and also everything felt like an experiment where you're approaching it with curiosity. And in my case, I don't care if I fail, like if the result is not what it should be or not pleasant enough. I'm happy to go about and, you know, I like the challenge of finding out what was wrong with it.
Sure. And so, okay, let's fast forward to today. And you write, certainly this is not all the stuff you do, but you write a lot about the science behind recipes.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people who read you would assume that, you know, cooking for you is about very precise formulas, doing things exactly the same way every time, the sort of like scientific, rigorous consistency. But how much of cooking is actually instinctual for you?
A large part of it is instinctual. And I think because I come from a science background, a lot of people assume that I also sometimes have to work with so much precision. I don't. You know, as part of recipe tester's job is to have precision and build on reproducibility. And for that, yes. But to get even to that final stage, to me, that's more of the final stage of where I'm actually recipe testing. But before I get there, I use my intuition to guide me to get there. Because I need to develop the basic idea, concept behind a recipe. Are the flavors right? Is the texture right? And then when it comes down to actually finessing the recipe, that for me is the like the science and the reproducibility stage, because it's kind of like an experiment. You have to have a lot of imagination before you get there. It has to be driven by some kind of facts. That's true. Mm-hmm. But there also has to be some level of excitement, enthusiasm, and like you said, intuition that has to build you to that stage. So that's how I work.
Yeah. And so, okay, so let's talk about the actual act of cooking rather than you know, cooking for your recipes. You know, most people don't do their daily cooking from recipes, right? They either probably have some things they know how to make by heart or they can just kind of wing it. What are some of the ways that can help you become an intuitive cook, do you think?
Definitely trusting your instincts. And the only way to do that is to build them, right? And one of the things, I am very visceral with my food. I will go and touch and smell things, taste them in their native state, or I mean raw state, or after they're cooked to see what the differences are. Because, I mean, you know, with spices, one of the most common examples I can tell you is, you know, you taste a spice raw, you smell it raw, it will be quite different than after it's toasted or, you know, if it's mixed with something else. So to build that sense, because that helps you produce predictability. You kind of know what to expect. That I found has really helped me. For example, if I'm zesting, say, a lemon or a lime or orange for a cake, I have learned over time that putting it into a fat as soon as I do it gives me better retention of that flavor after it's baked. versus me adding it at the end. And when I think about it, the science of that is quite simple because those essential oils are fat soluble. So throwing them into a fat right at the start helps hold it much better than if I just threw it. So kind of like understanding how it just behaves by itself and then also putting in the science and the facts behind it really helps me cook.
We're talking to Nick Sharma. His latest book is called The Flavor Equation, and he'll be back after a quick break with an amazing trick that happens when you mix oil and water. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're back with Nick Sharma, one of the great triple threats in cooking today. He's a dazzling photographer, a terrific recipe writer, and he backs it all up with his knowledge as a scientist. All right, so I want to play a little game with you.
Okay.
Because I want to get into your head, really as a cook, like not as an analyst of cooking, which is sort of how we're approaching the conversation, right? And, you know, before we got together today, I asked you to just sort of check your fridge and pantry and write down some of the stuff you have on hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, I figured if you don't know what you're going to make for dinner yet tonight, maybe we can do that work together right now. And I want to see how your mind works when you're just thinking of what to put together and how to make sure it's delicious. So how would you start?
Okay, so, I mean, whatever I'm craving, that's very important to me. Like, if I'm having a craving, that tends to supersede every decision I make.
Okay.
If I'm not craving anything in particular, like you said, like, I'll rummage through my fridge or through the pantry to see what's available. So I did a brief, like, look through today, and I have a lot of odd components. I've got a little bit of leftover plain rice. I've got some Greek yogurt that's plain and unsweetened. I have a little bit of fried chicken that I made, and I've got a bunch of herbs, so I need to use them up before they go bad. So I've got cilantro, and I've got dill and a mint. And then I've got a couple of serrano chili peppers, and I've got condiments. Now, I always have a lot of condiments because condiments are my saving grace in any meal.
What do you got?
Yeah, so I've got chili crisp ball, which I'm thinking of using for this particular, and eggs. I've got eggs, before I forget. Okay. Yeah. So I was thinking of doing a crispy rice kind of frittata where I am going to crisp the plain rice first on a skillet, and then I'm going to whisk the eggs with the herbs and chop up the fried chicken, add that in there, season it with a little bit of salt, and then a little bit of chili crisp oil, probably a generous tablespoon, and then I'm going to make a frittata with the crispy rice in it at the bottom.
Nice.
So it's kind of like a one pot thing, and I don't have to, you know, make 100 things to accompany it. And it's got a little bit of everything in there. So no one at home can complain.
Okay. That sounds very similar to how I might make something, which is I got this and this and this and this. How do I get them all together?
Yeah.
I like that you start with the rice, 'cause in my mind, probably 3/4 of my meals, in terms of what I'm thinking of making, start with the starch.
Yeah.
Is it a rice night? Is it a noodle night? Is it a pasta night? Is it a bread night? You know? Tell me about crisping the rice.
So personally, I like rice to be... So one of the things I grew up eating as a kid was just an omelet sometimes for lunch with plain rice. I think it might be a very... If you grew up in an Asian country, I feel like rice usually is a part of your diet at some point.
Yeah, for sure.
During the week. So usually plain rice is something like my grandmother would do if she was feeling lazy and had to watch her soap operas. I remember she would do just like take leftover rice from the previous day and then fry it a little bit in a teaspoon of oil or whatever, and then serve it with an omelet.
Okay.
So this is kind of like a play on that, where what I'm going to do is grease the pan with a little bit of oil. I'm going to use a cast iron pan, put the plain rice on top, and then I won't touch it till it just forms a crispy layer, kind of like a tahdig, but in reverse. And then leave it as is, and then pour the whisked eggs with all those, like the chicken and everything, folded up, just pour that on top, and then stick it into the oven.
So you're not concerned about re-crisping the fried chicken?
No, not really. You know, the rice is going to give me crispiness. So I've already built on that texture. I like to have a bunch of different textures within a dish. And I don't like too much of the same texture also. because I feel it feels very monotonous sometimes to eat the same boring texture. You know, it also changes how you experience taste.
What do you mean?
So depending on how texture and how food is shaped, it also affects how we perceive taste. A lot of it is how the brain responds. And actually, a lot of food companies play with this. If you look at potato chips, that's probably the most common example that comes to mind is the crispier and how it fractures and all that sound influences how we perceive the taste. And the higher the intensity, the better. Usually that's how it's kind of perceived by people, even though the recipe doesn't change. Same thing with chocolate, you know. I think Cadbury's a couple of years ago, they changed the shape of the chocolate. They didn't change the recipe, and people thought it was not as good as it was before because they were just so used to the shape.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Wait, okay. When you say texture influences how we perceive taste, break that down for me a little bit. That's fascinating. Like, crispiness is a texture most people love, right? And I think we associate it with, because you bring up potato chips, it makes me think of, like, we associate it with saltiness, sure. We associate it with fattiness. Is that what you mean? Like, if it's that texture, then we kind of associate with those things, and then we sort of subconsciously look for them? Like, tell me more what you mean about how it affects our...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things is that we're constantly primed for what should be with what.
Okay.
You know, if you look at a marketing campaign for... We'll talk about potato chips. I know I have potato chips in my head, but we'll talk about potato chips.
And I think about them all the time.
I mean, you look at the commercials, right? They'll show you a close-up of someone breaking a chip.
Sure.
And it's fracturing in real time. And then you see the salt flying off and it just looks so delicious and exciting. So your mind is primed to also know that the sound as well as the texture are part of that flavor experience. Now, if you eat a potato chip that has the same exact same recipe, but it just doesn't fracture as well, you'll be disappointed. And one of the things that's done in the potato chip industry is they actually measure even the sound of that fracture. To improve the experience of the customer. So it's like a lot of these things where we're just constantly thrown at us and we're primed. Take apples, for instance. Like, a crispy apple is just so much nicer than a mealy apple.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think even my dog likes mealy apples. But there's just something about to the element of sound and texture that plays in with flavor. And I definitely feel... we prime ourselves, even in restaurant menus, the way a recipe is described, you're going in with a certain mindset immediately as to what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of that plays into how we perceive flavor.
That's so interesting. And the idea of sound influencing our taste, it's really associated with the idea of texture, right?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, what's fascinating is that textures also are used to help deliver flavor often. Think about pasta, the different shapes of pasta, and the way certain types of pasta are used with certain sauces or certain dishes to hold that sauce. That's probably the most common example for us in our kitchens. You know, the shape of a taco chip to lift up, you know, the salsa, the guacamole, that's also just so important. What if it just like fell apart while you're like sinking it in? So... that's so important. And then another thing is the way we describe recipes also, and even menus, is when we describe the spices. I've often noticed, at least this is something that's predominantly done in the West, is describing a single spice or maybe the two or three key spices in the dish. So people are primed going in to expect those flavors.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot of priming that's done through language as well as through visuals in the way we perceive flavor on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And I think the main lesson here is when we say we're tasting things, it's not as simple as, oh, something goes into our mouth or, up into our nose in terms of the aroma, and then we just react and respond to it. It's, oh, our brain actually does a lot of work in immediately setting expectations for what's supposed to happen, what it expects to happen, what it wants to happen when we taste. And yeah, there are lots of ways of influencing.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Let me ask you one last thing that's actually not on this subject at all, but because I'm a little obsessed with it. I know, whatever, like if you're like a serious cook, you're supposed to make mayonnaise at home, whatever, I buy it. It's Hellman's. It's always better than anything anyone ever makes, whatever. But I never, ever make mayonnaise at home with olive oil. because I did it once and it was so bitter. And I thought I was nuts because I'd never heard of that before. It didn't make sense. I didn't put anything unusual. I didn't put anything bitter in the thing, but I was like, I just got gun shy. Like, I never want to do that again. Never want to experience that again. And then you wrote that there was a reason for it. And so yeah. I'm not nuts. And there's a way to get around it. So please, for anyone who ever has that, feels lonely like I did, like, oh, I don't want to make me at home with olive oil. It hates me. Please tell us so we can all feel not alone again.
So it's probably one of the most controversial things I've ever written. I didn't realize it would be, because people perceive bitterness to different levels. Mm-hmm. Some people are more sensitive to bitterness than others because of genetics. You just cannot deny that it's like a proven fact that based on certain mutations in our genome, some people are more sensitive to bitterness and some to specific bitter ingredients too. Like, I don't like bitter foods at all. I do not drink beer. I'm one of the few people in a bar that will just go with a plain vodka soda or something. Mm-hmm. I just do not do beer. But so the bitterness in olive oil comes from the phenols, and phenols are known to be bitter molecules in a lot of our food substances. They're also quite healthy, depending on the type of phenols. And so in olive oil, I wrote about it in the cookbook because, like you said, it was one of the biggest problems for me. I've always wanted to do an olive oil or a mustard oil-based mayonnaise. And the same problem arises is that it is so bitter that it's disgusting to taste.
But even though, like, the olive oil, it can be delicious on its own, but like when you make the mayonnaise with it, it becomes bitter.
Yeah, and that's because of water. The phenols that are present in olive oil, and I also found out that it's the same thing with mustard oil.
Okay.
They are soluble in both fat and water. And as soon as we add water to this oil and we whisk it up, the phenols, even though they're both soluble in water and in fat, they have a higher solubility in water. And so what happens is the phenols start to move into the water phase of the emulsion, which in this case is mayonnaise, and your tongue starts to taste that bitterness excessively. So if you're tasting olive oil, you won't really taste that bitterness excessively. It's very mild. Some people can taste it. And there's a lot of plant breeding that's done to get rid of it also. But when you put it with water, it starts to become much more prominent to our taste buds.
Okay.
And so that's when it comes into play. So if you're making aioli, mayonnaise, or even just a simple vinaigrette, if you're using olive oil and vinegar and you start whisking it, just taste it. You'll taste the bitterness from the olive oil. And so what I found out, and this was through quite a random thing, I noticed that people like David Lebowitz, who's one of my favorite pastry chefs and authors, he was boiling his oranges with water before he made marmalade. Orange pith is bitter, right? And a lot of people don't like marmalade due to the bitterness. So that gave me my first clue. Maybe this is something similar. And then the second thing was I came across a paper for reusing olive plant waste. Okay. And they were extracting the same chemicals that were in the leaves that are also present in the olive fruit.
I love that this is something you came across.
I'm always looking at food waste papers to see how I can use their technology and apply it to cooking.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool.
And so that was one of the things, that they were taking this olive plant refuse, which is just waste that the industry would otherwise throw out, and they were trying to extract this chemical and use it. And it's the same chemical that's present in olive oil that produces bitterness.
Okay.
And then I also read that when people pickle olives, they also wash it with water.
Okay, yeah.
To get rid of the bitterness. And so all of this kind of then made sense for me that maybe I should just wash olive oil with water. And that's what I did. And it also turns out that the boiling water produces the best extraction. So it's the best to wash away all that bitterness. And so I tried different temperatures with different brands of olive oil. And then I, you know, went through the process of making mayonnaise with each one of them. The one that was with boiling water did not taste bitter at all. And so that's when I said, aha, this is kind of like, now I can make mayonnaise. And it makes sense to me.
That's amazing. Just in like 10 seconds or less, can you describe what you mean by washing oil?
Not
intuitive for like
it's basically, I'm just taking water, hot boiling water with the oil, shaking it up, or you can whisk it to be a little more safe, and then letting it sit because there's no emulsifying agent, so they'll separate easily.
And the water then extracts those phenols and it stays in the water.
Yeah, and then I toss the water out and use the oil.
Amazing. Nick, it was so fun to talk with you.
Likewise. Thanks, Francis.
Nick Sharma is the author of The Flavor Equation, and he left us with a recipe for shepherd's pie that's not just plain old meat potatoes. He makes his with keema, one of my absolute favorite spiced meat mixes, and with chorizo. Find it at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Thanks for hanging with us. I'm sorry if I upset anyone by slandering Remy the Rat, but now I hope you see what I mean by how we have to cook by feel. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Keep your people safe. We'll talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. APM studios are run by Lily Kim, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman is our executive producer. The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper and is made every week by technical producer Jenny Lupke, associate producer Erica Romero, and managing producer Sally Swift. James Napoli is our digital producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.